Welcome to the Business of Behavior podcast, hosted by Dr. Becca Tagg. We support clinicians who have been bitten by the entrepreneurial bug, looking to strengthen their practice to better serve their clients, employees, and themselves.
Hello and welcome to the Business of Behavior podcast. I am your host, Dr. Becca Tagg. Today is going to be an article review session. I started these a little over a year ago to help give people another way to access the literature. Podcasts seem to be a helpful and easy way for people to get information, and my hope is that by embedding some articles into podcasts, that can help us all, myself included, interact more with articles. The one I selected for today comes from Behavior Analysis and Practice in 2018, and it is titled Board Certified Behavior Analysts and Psychotropic Medications, Slipshod Training, Inconsistent Involvement, and Reason for Hope. And it's by Anita Lee and Alan Poling. I'll have a link to it in the show notes. I selected this article specifically because, as some of you guys may know, I completed postdoctoral training in clinical psychopharmacology to be able to move towards what in psychology we call RXP, or prescriptive privilege. And perhaps I should do another podcast session about RXP and what the training looks like, the purpose of it, all of that, to give more background. But needless to say, it is an area of interest for me because as a behavior analyst and as a person with prescriptive privilege where permitted, which is a lot of P's, I believe that the two can work really well together. Our data can be super helpful with helping prescribers make the best decisions for the clients they're serving. And it's also maybe an area where I haven't seen as much collaboration, probably due to lack of understanding. So again, I'm looking forward to this article, and I hope you guys are too. Again, it's Board Certified Behavior Analysts and Psychotropic Medications, Slipshod Training, Inconsistent Involvement, and Reason for Hope. It was published in the Behavior Analysis and Practice in 2018 by Anita Lee and Alan Poling. Abstract. People with autism spectrum disorder often receive psychotropic medications, and two drugs, risperidone and aripiprazole, are approved for treating irritability in this population. A number of authors have suggested that behavior analysts can contribute to the prudent use of such drugs, but little is known regarding board-certified behavior analysts' involvement in practices relevant to the use of psychotropic drugs. We emailed board-certified behavior analysts an anonymous web-based survey regarding such practices. A majority of respondents work with individuals with autism spectrum disorder who take at least one psychotropic medication, but respondents' training relevant to psychotropic medications is inconsistent. Many report that their training is inadequate. They do not regularly work as part of interdisciplinary teams concerned with medications, and behavior analytic interventions are not typically evaluated before drugs are prescribed. Nonetheless, the majority of respondents reported that medications sometimes produce beneficial effects. Those involved in training behavior analysts should consider the competencies needed for graduates to work effectively as members of teams concerned with the optimal use of medications and how to foster and assess those competencies. Behavior analysts should also work to develop and implement strategies that foster collaboration with psychiatrists and other physicians. Psychotropic drugs are often prescribed for people with autism, and both risperidone and aripiprazole are approved for reducing irritability, which comprises self-injury, aggression, tantrums, and other challenging responses. Respondents are not consistently involved in monitoring the effects of psychotropic drugs, which are often administered prior to evaluating an alternative, less restrictive intervention. Respondents are not trained consistently with respect to matters relevant to psychotropic drugs, and many apparently are not trained adequately. People involved in training behavior analysts should consider the competencies needed for graduates to work effectively as members of teams concerned with the optimal use of medications and how to foster and assess those competencies. Behavior analysts should also work to develop and implement strategies that foster collaboration with psychiatrists and other physicians. Psychotropic drugs are commonly prescribed in attempts to reduce challenging behaviors in people with ASD. Although prevalence rates differ substantially across studies, most report that approximately 40 to 50% of sampled individuals were receiving or had received at least one psychotropic medication. No medication is currently approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, for treating the defining behavioral features, such as those core features, right, of autism, but two drugs, risperidone, trade name for that is Risperdal, and aripiprazole, trade name Abilify, are FDA approved for treating irritability in children and adolescents diagnosed with ASD. Irritability is a shorthand label for several forms of challenging behavior, including crying, self-injury, aggression directed towards others, and property destruction. The Aberrant Behavior Checklist, a symptom checklist that is completed by a caregiver, is a widely used measure of irritability. The community version of the checklist, comprising 58 items, is used in most studies. The widespread use of psychotropic medications in both people with ASD and in other populations is relevant to the discipline of applied behavior analysis in at least three ways. First, some behavior analysts are highly critical of the use of psychotropic drugs, while others are more accepting. Second, the research methods characteristic of ABA, including the use of small n within subject designs and direct repeated measures of target behaviors, functional assessment of target behaviors, and social validation are of clear value in clinical psychopharmacology. Although they are not generally accepted by the FDA or the medical profession. Third, the strategies that applied behavior analysts use in the everyday evaluation of their interventions are often appropriate for the everyday evaluation of psychotropic medication. Clearly, behavior analysts can be valuable members of treatment and research teams concerned with the effects of psychotropic medication in individuals with ASD or other clinical conditions. Both Broadhead and Newhouse, Oystein, Peck, Conway, and Frieder recently proposed strategies to ensure that interdisciplinary teams, which include behavior analysts, function effectively. And I'll step away from the article for a moment to say that that article, the Broadhead article, was one of the first article reviews that I did. So if you're interested in listening to that, you can check that out on thebusinessofbehavior.com. Back to the article. Unfortunately, neither these nor other authors who have argued that behavior analysts can play a valuable role in the appropriate use of psychotropic drugs, including us, have considered the specific skills that behavior analysts need to participate meaningfully in treatment teams. The best way to establish those skills and the ubiquity of such skills in BCBA practitioners. These topics are highly worthy of discussion, and some of the questions in the survey we conducted are relevant to them. The purpose of our survey was to obtain information regarding the role that practitioners who serve clients with ASD actually play in evaluating drug effects, the role they believe they should play in assessing drug effects, and their background regarding psychotropic medications. Methods. An electronic survey was sent via the Behavior Analyst Certification Board email campaign to BCBAs of all levels. The email list contained 17,780 names. Of them, 2,842 received the survey and 253 completed it. It's about 8.9%. These data were provided by the BACB email service. The reported data are based on the response of the 253 people who completed the survey. Data were summarized for all respondents who completed the last question of the survey. Not all questions were completed by all respondents, but all questions were completed by 90.12% of respondents. The remaining respondents completed all of the Likert scale questions, and their data are included in these questions. We prepared a brief questionnaire hosted by Qualtrics comprising 7 demographic questions and 21 content questions. Questions and choice options are shown in Table 1, 2, 3, and 4. Again, there'll be a link to this study in the show notes so that you can go directly to the horse's mouth, so to speak. Content questions focused on the practitioner's training and knowledge regarding psychotropic drugs, how they were involved in evaluating the effects of psychotropic medications, and how they viewed their role of behavior analysts in evaluating medications. 11 items were 5 choice Likert scale items with always and never as endpoints. 8 other items were forced choice questions with 5 options. 3 items asked open-ended questions as follow-ups to specific answer choices. A thematic analysis was used to isolate major recurring themes in the responses to those questions. Thematic analysis is a 6-stage process which involves an initial reading of the responses, generating an initial coding hierarchy, preliminary coding, thematic construction, revision, and consolidation. One person independently performed a thematic analysis of all the responses, then a second person independently applied the thematic categories isolated by the first person to evaluate 82 of the 407 written responses, selected at random. The ratings of the two individuals agreed for 90.24% of the responses. The two raters reached a consensus regarding the 8 responses that were initially evaluated differently, and the consensus rating is reported. Results. Demographic information for respondents appear in Table 1, and information for clients served by respondents appears in Table 2. The majority of respondents were female BCBAs holding a master's degree and residing in the USA. Most respondents primarily provided services to individuals diagnosed with ASD, that was about 75%, in an in-home setting, 56%, public or private schools, 50%, and centers or clinic, about 38%. Most respondents provided services to clients 0 to 5, that was 72%, 6 to 13 years, 86%, 14 to 18, 71%, and 19 to 26 years, about 53%. A note that the totals can sum to more than 100% because people can serve more than one age group. Although our initial plan was to statistically analyze data as a function of respondent characteristics, there were too few responses in many categories to make such an analysis meaningful. The problem of small n's within data cells was exacerbated because some questions permitted multiple response options, which substantially increased the number of respondent categories that must be considered. Finally, there's disagreement among statisticians as to how ordinal data like those obtained with the Likert-style questions should be statistically analyzed, and some contest that parametric statistics are inappropriate. Given these considerations, few comparisons of findings across respondent categories or statistical analyses are reported. When asked, what percentage of your clients are currently taking psychotropic medication? 2% indicated that 0 were taking medication, and 7% indicated they do not know. A similar percentage of respondents indicated that many of their clients were currently taking psychotropic medication. The authors obviously break this down in very specific percentages of the different groups, and because we're doing this orally, it could get confusing to hear. So I'm going to skip over some of that and encourage you again to go back to the article to really digest all of the specifics that are reported. Responses to questions concerning respondents' training and knowledge regarding psychotropic medication is shown in Table 3. Approximately half, so 52%, of the respondents indicated their training regarding psychotropic medication was primarily through self-study or through a class. And 13% reported having no relevant training. A majority of respondents, 58%, indicated that their knowledge of the uses and effects of psychotropic medication was somewhat or completely adequate. A slightly lower percentage of BCBAs than BCBADs reported that their knowledge was somewhat or completely adequate. Chi-square analysis indicated that this difference was not significant at P being less than 0.05. Only 7% of respondents rated their knowledge as extremely inadequate. The most frequently reported sources of information given to prescribing physicians regarding the behavioral effects of medication were direct measures of behavior and anecdotal information provided by caretakers or other professionals. Behavior analysts selected adverse effects to track based on parent concerns, direct observations of potentially adverse effects, and effects reported on drug package labels. Table 4 summarizes responses to questions concerned with current practice and opinions regarding psychotropic medications. Most, so 60%, of the respondents always or very often know the specific psychotropic medications their clients are taking and when the drugs or doses changed. Only 9% rarely or never do so. Moreover, 70% of respondents knew the intended effects of the medication their clients receive. Nonetheless, only 20% of them always or very often work directly with the prescribing physician to develop strategies for measuring the intended effects. A substantially larger percentage, 45%, work directly with people other than prescribing physicians to develop such measures. According to over half of the respondents, so 58%, behavioral data reflecting the intended effects of psychotropic medications are rarely or never used by the prescribing physician in making treatment decisions. About a quarter of respondents, 26%, reported, however, that the prescribing physician always or very often uses such data. A substantially higher percentage of BCBAs than BCBADs reported that physicians rarely or never use such data. Chi-square analysis revealed that this difference was not significant at the 0.05 level. There was a smaller difference in the percentage of BCBAs and BCBADs who reported that they always or very often do so, and this difference was not statistically significant at the 0.05 level. When asked, how often are you involved in measuring possible adverse effects of medications, 26% indicated always or very often, and a slightly larger percentage, in 33%, indicated that their clients were always or very often served by an interdisciplinary team of which the behavior analyst is a member, and issues related to psychotropic medications are directly assessed. Most respondents, 64%, reported that their clients sometimes derive significant benefit from psychotropic drugs. Few indicated that their clients always do, so 0.45%, or never, 2%, do. Hang with me because we're getting close to the discussion, and so I want to deliver this data and encourage you to go directly to the article to hear it and stay tuned for implications coming in the discussion part of this article. When asked, could you play a larger and more valuable role in ensuring psychotropic drugs are used to maximally benefit your client, 81% of respondents said yes. Respondents who answered yes were invited to answer an open-ended question that asked, what would allow you to play a larger and more valuable role? A total of 168 people wrote a response. Of them, 30 were BCBADs and 128 were BCBAs. The thematic analysis yielded three major themes in responses to this and the other two open-ended questions. One theme generally related to the importance of data, the second to the importance of collaboration, and the third to the appropriate training of behavior analysts. Overall, 55% of respondents who answered yes to when they asked if they could play a larger role indicated that increased opportunities to collaborate, typically with physicians, would allow them to do so. 60% of BCBAD respondents and 57% of BCBA respondents did so. Slightly fewer, 42%, reported that collecting and using better measurement systems would suffice, and substantially fewer, 20%, noted that better training would be sufficient. Again, remember that percentages can sum to over 100% because two or more themes could be evident in a single response. In all, 91% of participants indicated that behavior analysts should be routinely involved in monitoring of drug effects in their clients. Respondents who so indicated were invited to answer an open-ended question that read, why should behavior analysts be involved? A total of 200 responses were provided, and the majority of those responses, 73%, indicated that the primary value of involving behavior analysts was their skill in collecting data and behavior observations. Substantially fewer, 27%, indicated that collaboration between behavior analysts and physicians was necessary for drugs to be used effectively. Respondents were asked, is it outside the realm of the competency of applied behavior analysts and hence ethically inappropriate for them to be involved in evaluating medication effects? Most of the respondents, 69%, said no. 6% answered yes, and 18% answered other. The 38 respondents who answered other were asked to please describe the reason for that response. The most common answer provided by 57% of respondents was that behavior analysts should be involved in collecting data relevant to clinical decision-making, but not in making treatment decisions. Similarly, 50% emphasized that behavior analysts should simply consult with other people. Discussion. Before discussing the results of this survey, it is important to emphasize that they are limited in three regards. First, the present data are self-reported, with the potential weakness inherent to such data. Second, the sample is rather small and may not be representative of the population of interest. For instance, 7% of all certified behavior analysts are BCBADs and 9% are BCABAs. BCBADs accounted for 15% of our respondents and BCABAs for 3%. Third, the response rate is low. According to the organization that emailed the surveys, 2,842 BCBAs received the survey. Only 253 completed it, and it cannot be assumed that these individuals are representative of the population of BCBAs. It is, for example, possible that the respondents are especially interested in the survey's subject matter, psychotropic medications, and hence different from most BCBAs. Although this possibility cannot be ruled out, it is interesting that the return rate in the present study is similar to that obtained in prior published studies that used the same or very similar recruitment strategy and dealt with other topics. Online surveys yield relatively low response rates due to a variety of factors, such as emails not being received or being automatically marked as spam. The extent to which these factors influence the response rate in the present survey is unknown, but it does appear prudent for future researchers to use an alternative strategy. Although there is substantial variability in the respondents' answers to most of the questions, there is sufficient consistency to support 5 points. One is that nearly all of the respondents provide services to clients with ASD who receive psychotropic medications, although the reported percentage of medicated clients differed widely across clients. These findings are unsurprising given that the overall prevalence of psychotropic drug use in this population is relatively high, but differed from 19.5% to 65% in published studies. A second point is that respondents gained information about psychotropic medications in a number of ways, and that fewer than 40% did so by taking a class as part of their degree program. Interestingly, there was very little difference in the percentage of BCBAs and BCBADs who gained information by taking a class. Chi-square analysis revealed that this difference was not statistically significant at the p being less than 0.05 level. A slight majority of respondents indicated their knowledge of the uses and effects of psychotropic medications was somewhat or extremely adequate, but neither the present data nor any other data provide evidence of whether or not behavior analysts typically have the competence necessary to serve effectively on interdisciplinary teams concerned with psychotropic medication. In fact, those competencies have, to our knowledge, not ever been specified. The BACB task list from 2012 makes no mention of psychotropic medication or any other topic uniquely related to clinical psychopharmacology, and it appears that many, probably most, BCBA training programs largely ignore the subject. The lack of systematic, required training is clearly evident in the answers of our respondents who reported that they were trained in a variety of ways, most often through self-study. Unsurprisingly, only 6 in 10 reported that their knowledge of psychotropic medication was somewhat or completely adequate. If behavior analysts are to regularly be involved in ensuring that medications are used to produce maximal benefit in their clients, then it is essential that they be appropriately trained, which will require modification of current educational and assessment strategies. Interestingly, results of a recent study of behavior analysis course sequence coordinators indicate that many believe there's too little coverage of basic science topics such as behavioral pharmacology, so there may be some enthusiasm for broadening the scope of behavior analysis training. If behavior analysis is to fulfill its promise as a contributor to the rational, effective use of psychotropic drugs, then those involved in training and certification must think carefully about how students should be trained and assessed, and how they can more readily serve on interdisciplinary teams. One possibility is to combine training in a behavior analysis program with conventional medical education. It might, for instance, be tenable to have students jointly educated in a physician's assistant or nurse practitioner program and in a behavior analysis program. Grant funding should be available to establish such a model program, which might well serve our initial and invaluable bridge, which might serve as an initial and invaluable bridge between medicine and our discipline. Specifically, training behavior analyst students to work productively as members of inter- and multidisciplinary teams that include medical doctors is likely to bear fruit. Third, a majority of respondents indicated that their clients sometimes derive significant benefit from psychotropic medications. This outcome is consistent with research finding in several studies, indicating that antipsychotic medications often produce undesired behaviors in people with autism, and although the evidence is less strong, other drug classes can also produce beneficial effects. Of course, behavior analytic interventions are also often effective in reducing undesired behaviors in people with autism, as well as increasing desired responding. Direct comparisons of behavior analytic and pharmacological intervention are very rare. For example, no study has directly compared the effects of risperidone and a behavior analytic treatment on irritability. It is the case, however, that risperidone can produce a range of adverse effects, and this is true of all psychotropic medication. Most behavior analytic intervention rarely, if ever, produces significant side effects, although there are clear exceptions. Putting those exceptions aside, behavior analytic interventions can accurately be viewed as a less restrictive intervention than psychotropic drugs. One of the fundamental precepts of bioethics is, first, do no harm. With this precept in mind, the fourth noteworthy point supported by our finding is that only 4 in 10 respondents reported a behavior analytic intervention was always or very often evaluated in their clients prior to medication use. In contrast, 9 in 10 indicated that this should occur. Physicians, of course, are not in the business of arranging behavior analytic interventions. Rather, they are trained to use psychotropic drugs to deal with behavioral challenges, and in doing so, they are operating within the ethical and legal boundaries of their disciplines and are offering what is often the only tenable treatment option given their training and the limited time they have to spend with individual clients. It is natural and appropriate for a physician who is asked to help in improving someone's behavior to prescribe a psychotropic drug, regardless of whether or not that person is diagnosed with autism. In doing so, they are using tools that are both familiar and arguably the best at their disposal. Unfortunately, the empirical justification for using those tools is often weak. For example, people with ASD sometimes receive risperidone in combination with another drug with the goal of reducing undesired behavior. But a recent review of the literature finds that there is a dearth of published studies to support this practice. Moreover, when there is compelling evidence that a drug is generally not all treated, individuals respond favorably to it. That is, for example, true with respect to the effects of risperidone on irritability. Regardless of whether an intervention is or is not evidence-based or is not pharmacological, sound clinical practice comprises 3 components. First, the goals of the treatment must be clear and in the client's best interest. Second, the effects of the treatment must be assessed in a manner that is adequate to determine whether those goals are attained. Third, decisions regarding continuation and modification of treatment must be based on its actual effects. Behavior analysts are, of course, committed to this model of clinical practice and trained to be expert in its use. For that reason, as many respondents pointed out and several authors have suggested, they could potentially play a valuable role in the interdisciplinary teams committed to the best possible use of psychotropic medications. Unfortunately, few respondents function as members of such teams. This is the 5th point supported by the present findings. It appears that cost is one reason why interdisciplinary teams that include a behavior analyst are not typically in place when psychotropic drugs are prescribed for people with autism. Who would pay for such teams? Professional prerogatives and precedents are another. Only properly licensed professionals can administer psychotropic medications, and for the most part, those individuals are physicians. Historically, behavior analysts and physicians have not worked together. There are, however, some exceptions, and a few respondents indicated that they were part of them. Describing the success of joint efforts at conferences attended by physicians and in journals regularly read by physicians is another potential strategy for increasing interdisciplinary teaming. And we have reached the end of the article. So again, the title of this article is Board Certified Behavior Analysts and Psychotropic Medications, Slipshod Training, Inconsistent Involvement, and Reason for Hope. It was published in the Behavior Analysis and Practice in 2018, and the authors are Anita Lee and Alan Poling. I am looking forward to hearing kind of what people's thoughts are about this article and sharing maybe some of my own experience when I do a podcast session on the RXP training or the prescriptive training that I've received, because I do think that it has greatly enabled me to work with prescribers. But as I hesitate in saying prescriber, because it's more than just the prescribers, it's any medical professional I have a better understanding of biology and medication and the systems of care that are more representative in the medical community rather than maybe behavioral health or mental health. Although my training as a psychologist really helps in that mental health piece too. And so I think that all of the education and experiences that I've had are what helped me to be successful in those early conversations. And then those successes provide me an opportunity to remain in a seat at that table. And it isn't always that way. So there were times when I was in my postdoctoral training program in California, and they would, the psychiatry residents, which is who you go through some of the program with for the practicum piece, would call me a NARD, which stood for not a real doctor, because I wasn't an MD, and that was really hard. I was also the only female, which was also really hard. And I think that in many ways, those experiences were really punishing for me. I felt not a part of. And luckily for me, I tend to use that as a, I will show you that I can do this. And it motivates me. But I also could see that for others who have maybe a similar experience, it could be punishing enough that we may not want to do it anymore. So again, I hope that this was an interesting article review, and I will share a little bit more about my prescriptive privilege journey in another podcast session. I want to be mindful of time as we hit that 30-minute mark, since time is one of our most valuable resources because it's limited. I appreciate those of you that are regularly choosing to spend time with me, Dr. Becca Tagg, on the Business of Behavior podcast or in the ABA Business Builders Facebook group. And I welcome you guys to send emails or messages or comments, whatever feels most comfortable for you about feedback, suggestions, thoughts, feelings, reactions. I also want to encourage you to subscribe on iTunes. That lets iTunes know that it's valuable content and will help ensure that more episodes are available. I hope you guys have a great rest of your day.